ハリラモン、ハリラモン。はぁ、シー。Is that the Lita Sundari there or the other one? that's Karina Alsa. So you have you're getting a new guitar player in the family or something? Round out the band. But I would read a bit from the book I'm working on, since I know the Perth Yatra is famous for its brain power. Entertain you. I guess I'll read some of it and explain to you as we go along. This is a chapter called Vedic Time. So, the background is that what you would have found out in chapter 1, or chapter 2, this is chapter 7, is basically, you know, in the Western world, we have this conception that things are always getting better. We have this conception that there's a thing known as progress. And as time moves, we find out more and more about what reality is. Science gets better and better. Medicine gets better and better. The conveniences get better and better. This is a conception that's very much embedded in Western culture. Now, whether it's justified or not, that's another thing. But somehow or other, if you meditate on your upbringing and the conceptions you had, you'll see that basically you thought you were part of a society which was always getting better. So now, as economic decline is setting in, people are getting worried because no longer can they think that our children will automatically have a better future than we did. No longer do people think like that, and it's very, very unsettling for them. But what is this concept of progress anyway? For example, you say that people are living longer, but if you calculate the death rate by including the number of abortions, you may get a different figure. You say that there's progress because science has stopped so many diseases. But every time they stop one disease, a new one comes. And then even the old ones are coming back. And if the old ones don't come back naturally, they're manufacturing old diseases to spread through chemical warfare. Just like anthrax, dreaded disease of the Middle Ages. Armies are making huge stockpiles of anthrax, chemical weapons, to spread everywhere. So on the one hand, they tell you to be proud of science. They're conquering so many diseases. On the other hand, they're bringing back these old diseases in manufactured form to kill people with. So where's the progress? The fact is, you cannot alter the amount of happiness and distress that's packed into your body at the time of birth. Prahlad Maharaj explains this. Sukham andhyakam daicha deha yogena dehinam. Your happiness and distress comes with the body. It's already metered. It's already regulated. So you're going to get what you're supposed to get. Material adjustment will not reduce your distress or raise your happiness. In fact, the more you try to maneuver and adjust, you make things more complicated, you make things worse. Just like a fly that gets caught in some honey. The fly is buzzing around the room, and then it sees some attractive honey, and the fly lands in the honey. What happens? The more the fly struggles, the worse it is. Now, if you're in Western culture, you'll think, I'm struggling, I'm making progress. But what actually is going on is the more you try to adjust your way out of situations, the worse they become. what's happening as you're struggling and adjusting? You are piling up more bad karma for yourself. Because you don't know what you're doing, you think, I'm improving, I'm making progress, but actually, the more you interact with material nature, the more you bring suffering upon yourself, because you don't know what you're doing. Just like a fly in the honey. The more you struggle, the worse it becomes. So where is this idea of progress coming from? It is a complete delusion. Now, part of it is based in Christianity. We're going to discuss something called the linear conception of time and the cyclical conception of time. Why do you think that the cyclical conception of time, cycles, is primitive? Why do you think that time moving in a straight line from point A to point B, why do you think that's very advanced? So much of that Western conception is based simply on Judeo-Christianity. The Christian conception is that Jesus appeared, and from that point on, the universe, not even the universe, the planet Earth, took on a completely different orientation, and it's a straight line from Jesus' appearance until the judgment day. And everything is unique. It's never happened before. There's a unique appearance of Jesus. There's the unique judgment day. That's it. Now, the Vedic presentation of time is completely different. Things move in cycles. What comes around goes around. There's nothing new that's happening. That's why the Vedic sages, in speaking Srimad Bhagavatam, they did not pay attention to so many unimportant things. They were concerned, how are people escaping the wheel of time? That's more important than describing the wheel of time going around and round. The most important thing is how to get off. But Western scholars, when they look at the Vedas, they say, there's just no chronological order. There's no conception of time moving in a straight line. These people just, they were very confused. No, the people were very advanced. They knew, why should we pay so much attention to things that just constantly move in cycles? Samsara, the wheel of birth and death. It's just going round and round. Let's pay attention to people who get free of the wheel of time. So it's a completely different way of looking at things. You know, when you read the Bhagavatam, you find out that Shukadeva Goswami explains, Ayurhariti Bhai Punsam. By the rising and setting of the sun, your lifespan's being taken away. You may think the sunrise and the sunset is very beautiful, but what's happening is your lifespan is being robbed every time the sun rises and sets. And in the fourth canto, you read about the allegory of Paranjan, in which the days and nights are compared to soldiers that plunder your lifespan. 365 day soldiers, 365 night soldiers, they're attacking your life and carrying it away. Lord Kapiladev points out that just like a mass of clouds is unaware of the wind that any moment can blow them away, similarly the living entity is unaware of the time factor. And Muchakunda in Krishna Leela, King Muchakunda, he was talking about himself. He said, although I forgot about time, time did not forget about me. At the right moment, like a black snake, time came and gobbled me up. It's always a very nice line for you to remember. I forgot about time, but time didn't forget about me. So, we really have to take another look at this Western view of time, that things should always get better, things are always advancing. It is not so. People are in such anxiety today. Formerly, people lived simply, but they didn't have so many mental complications. They didn't have the luxuries, and they didn't have the complications. The complications have brought on so much mental distress. So I'll read a little bit. Unlike time, in both the Judeo-Christian religious tradition and the current view of modern science, Vedic time is cyclic. What goes around comes around. What goes up must come down, and vice versa. The Vedic universe passes through repetitive cycles. Moreover, the entire cosmos itself undergoes recurring cycles of creation and destruction. During the annihilation of the universe, energy is conserved to manifest again in the next creation. Our contemporary knowledge embraces a version of change and progress that is linear. The saga of the universe proceeds in a straight line from unique point A and ends at unique point B. Obviously, because this modern conception of time differs so markedly from the Vedic vision, we will expect to find two significantly different approaches to life. So this is a point for you to remember. Because there's a great difference between the Vedic view of time and the Western view of time, you should immediately expect to find different approaches to life. Once again, the Western view of time is, it's a unique line from point A to point B. And the Vedic conception is, it's a circle. Nothing is happening new. Things are just repeating themselves. Creation, annihilation. It's a circle. So, you're going to find two different kinds of people. Western civilization fosters people who think, we're moving forward, we're progressing, things are getting better. They have hope in material nature. Vedic civilization fosters persons who think, there's nothing new happening. Just birth, death, disease, and old age. Things are moving through the cycle. Let's get free of this wheel of time. Our scene for gaining admittance to the world of Vedic time is a great gathering of sages near the Himalayas in a forest still known today as Naimisaranya. You'll still find Naimisaranya, but some kilometers away from Lucknow. You have been there? Yeah. Railway station, Nimsar. So, the approximate date of the meeting is 5,000 years ago, at the onset of what the Vedas refer to as Kali Yuga, or the Age of Quarrel, the worst of the cycle of four Vedic ages. Now, this is another great difference. Western people are taught that the way things are today, it's the best ever. The brains are getting bigger. The intelligence is better. Knowledge is better. Everything is better. What is the Vedic view? This is the worst time. Completely the opposite. So obviously we're going to be dealing with two completely different kinds of people with two completely different kinds of outlooks. You've been taught in school that this is great. Things have never been better. There may be a few wars, a few social problems, but still, never before has man been so great. Srimad Bhagavatam will tell you, never before has man been so bad off. Great difference. The opposite. This is why it's very difficult for non-devotees and devotees to associate. You're getting to some of the root reasons why it's not possible. They're feeling very optimistic. We're making progress. There's been some peace in the world. Sometimes the United Nations works. And we are thinking, it's all useless. Don't you know this is Kali Yuga? This is the bottom of the trash can. Looking into the future, the assembled sages, as relayed in the Srimad Bhagavatam, knew what was nearing. based on their knowledge of cosmic cycles. They wanted to prepare themselves and humanity, so they convened in the forest for a meeting of marathon duration. How can the population best survive the coming Iron Age with its notorious focus on machines, machine-like people, and mechanistic thinking? At Naimisaranya, the best brains deliberated on this crisis for the welfare of society. So people like to talk about the welfare of society, but what do they know? They have no qualifications to think about what's good for the people. Because they have no qualifications to think about what's the good, they elect so many crazy people who simply waste the people's time, take their money. They simply send actors into their government, persons who can say anything just to be worshipped, just to get some fame. If you want to think about the good of people, you have to have qualification. This is what the sages at Naimisaranya are teaching you. They're not just a bunch of ordinary Joes who got together and said, oh, what's going to happen to the people? What to do? We love the people. We want to care. Let's have a meeting. Not like that at all. They had high qualifications. You can recall from the first chapter of the Bhagavatam how the sages at Naimisaranya, led by Shonakarishi, they approached Sutta Goswami. They stated his qualifications. You're free from vice. You've gone through all the Vedic literatures, and more importantly, you've explained them. You're gentle, submissive, because of your devotional attitude. Your spiritual masters have blessed you. And most importantly, you know for what purpose Krishna took birth from Devaki. So they listed in several verses what the qualifications of Sutta Goswami were. So the meeting at Naimisaranya was of the most qualified persons who had the ability to think about the good of the people. That's another reason why it's very difficult for us to associate with non-devotees. We just will not accept that they have any ability to do any good. And they don't like this. But that's the way it is. They have no qualifications to think about what is the goal of life, what is the good of the people. In accord with Vedic methodology, the assembled sages recognized the most advanced transcendental scholar and yogi among them and deferred their judgment to him. Publicly avowing the qualifications of this chief sage, Sutta Goswami, they noted his complete freedom from vice and his erudition in the Vedic texts. In addition to his status as the eldest sadhu, he had been duly certified by his own preceptor in disciplic succession. That blessing meant Sutta Goswami was Bhagavan realized. He knew what lay beyond impersonal Brahman and the Supersoul. The sages, confident that their choice was a genuine master of spiritual science, prompted him for a pronouncement. Prayana Payusha Sabhya Kalavasmin Yuge Janaha Manda Sumanda Mateo Manda Bhagya Yupaduta. O learned one, in this iron age of Kali, men have but short lives. They are quarrelsome, lazy, misguided, unlucky, and above all, always disturbed. So, here you have the character analysis of people today. They will not accept this. They think, oh, we are so wonderful. Everything we're doing is getting better and better. And the Srimad Bhagavatam says, never have people been so bad. Never have people been so unqualified. So, we say that what we are seeing is not cultural advancement. We are seeing cultural degradation. Things are going down. But the materialists are intoxicated with their linear conception of time. Things are always moving straight ahead in a unique way that's never happened before. Things are always getting better and better. The Vedic cycle of yugas entails civilization beginning in an enlightened, advanced state and then gradually sinking to the pits of chaos and ignorance. Once the bottom of the cycle is reached, the cycle starts anew. Then the earth becomes populated with people in an original state of purity and astounding knowledge as the same progression repeats. This is why it's very important that we break the illusion that humanity is a recent development. What your scientists will tell you is that human beings as we know them today only came into existence, well, they used to say 40,000 years ago, now they're saying maybe 100,000 years ago. Human beings as we know them today came to existence then, and then by about 35 or 40,000 years ago, human beings like we have today, they predominated over the Neanderthals, more primitive types of humans. And civilization did not begin till around 4,000 BC. That means around 6,000 years ago, civilization began. And what does the Srimad Bhagavatam say? Civilization was great 100,000 years ago, 200,000 years ago, and 6,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, things started going down. So we are in complete disagreement. Where is the opportunity for compromise? The preceding ages, yugas, were known sequentially as Satya Yuga, Treta Yuga, and Dwarpa Yuga, or the golden, silver, and bronze ages. As the darkness of Kali Yuga began to fall, the sages braced themselves for what would inevitably ensue, the rapid demise of all the finer qualities in humanity. Anyone have any questions at this point? Yes.
Well, Maharaj, what process of coming to a conclusion did they use? There was no argument or back and forth or proposals.
Did who use? They deferred, as I told you, they deferred to Sutta Goswami. They didn't just say, okay, let's speculate. They said, let's find out the most qualified sage amongst us and let's ask him. Descending process. We thought we're supposed to have a vote, you know. Let's vote and see what the truth is. No. Vedic truth is descending. Veda Narayana Sat Shat. The Vedas are eternal. They're the breathing of Narayana. There's nothing new. Prabhupada would say that sometimes. There's no need for any research. The truth is already here. Oh, Westerners don't like that. What do you mean there's no need for any research? No need for speculation. So now we're talking a little bit about Kali Yuga here. Organized spiritual development. The bulwark of previous yugas would die a quick death, hastened by social institutions that militate against self-realization. This is a very important point. In previous yugas, spiritual development was organized on a mass scale. It wasn't just your individual thing. This is what's giving us such problems today. We're trying to individually endeavor in our spiritual life in a hostile atmosphere. Everything is pushing against enlightenment, against love of God. The society, the governmental system, the educational system, the economic system, everything is against God realization. But that's Kali Yuga. It wasn't always like that. In previous yugas, everything about society encouraged the development of God consciousness. The economics, the politics, the culture, the art, everything was to gradually or immediately foster the development of Krishna consciousness. So by hearing these things, we lose our attachment for the society as it is today. And that's necessary because it has no good value. The first time I saw Srila Prabhupada, he was roaring like a lion. He said, if you're optimistic about material life, you're an animal. If you're a human being, you must be pessimistic. But in Krishna consciousness, everything is optimistic. So we don't want to feel any attachment for society as it is today. We don't want to see any value. We see it for what it is, a garbage can. Colossal wars at the slightest misunderstanding would become routine events. Do you know how, you think there's been progress? Do you know how war has changed over the 20th century? In World War I, how many people died? Maybe, I don't know, 10, 14 million. Almost all of them were soldiers. In World War II, maybe 50 million people died. Still, most of them were soldiers. Then you get to the wars recently, like Vietnam and in the former Yugoslavia, Bosnia, Chechnya. Who's dying? Almost all civilians. This is progress. Now war means to kill the civilians, particularly kill the women and children. That's how they want to win the wars. The military men, they want to be safely on their ships or under the ground in bunkers or high overhead in planes, and they harass the civilians on the other side, and particularly they want to harass the women and children. So you say there's been progress. In Chechnya and in Bosnia, 90% of the casualties were not military personnel, they were civilians. So where is your progress, the straight line from point A to point B? As economic development and sensuality became the heart and soul of society, the people's intellect and physical strength would shrink, and their lifespan too. What happens whenever people read in the Vedas or even the Bible about people living for a long time? They just laugh. Fairy tales. We're not living a long time, so how can anybody live a long time? The eventual collapse of the family structure and social harmony would lay bare the battered individual to face the hailstorms of confusion alone. In previous times, even in Kali Yuga, just 100 years ago, just 50 years ago, even 30 years ago, there was some kind of family structure to protect the individual. Now there's no family. Children, by the time they're 13, they're dealing with the world completely alone. They're getting intoxicated, they're having illicit sex. Their parents think they're safe because they have cell phones. We'll give you a cell phone, dear. Progress is protecting you. Just go on to your parties, stay out at night, but you've got your cell phone. You can call home anytime. In fact, you know, just take a taxi home, we'll pay for it. Do what you like, be free. Yeah, girls will be girls, boys will be boys. We know how it is. There's no family protecting the individual anymore. So as soon as children reach 12 or 13, they're just thrown amongst the lions. They've got to fend for themselves. They're having illicit sex, getting intoxicated. They're doing things that their parents would wait until they were 18, or their grandparents would wait till they're 21. Now it's happening at 12 and 13. There's no more childhood. Very horrible. So you can see now, by the time girls, especially, when they reach the age of 16, they look so old. They look so withered. So spoiled. They actually don't have any teenage youthful years. I talk to them so often preaching. I say, now you are 18. Now you are 17. Do you understand that you've done everything already that you can look ahead to do in your life? You've already done it? And they're shocked. They say, yes, it's true. We don't have anything to look forward to. all the great experiences of material life we've already done. All they can hope to do is travel and do the same thing in different places. This is what's happening. How can you have a society in this kind of situation? It's impossible. The mystic and psychic powers commonplace in previous yugas will become extinct. What people talk about today as mystic and psychic powers is nothing. Bending spoons. So what if they can read someone's mind? Who wants to read people's filthy minds? This is what they call mystic power. Or, you know, that person in India who produces, you know, ashes. Oh, it's very wonderful. We can produce ash. Or some other, he pulls out a gold watch. This is very mystical. This is a part of Kali Yuga. That the psychic powers, the mystic powers, which every high-grade brahmana had, they'll be lost. When the young brahmana boy Sringi cursed Pritchett Maharaj, in fact, what did he say? Let the snake bird bite me, or whatever this brahmana boy has said. I don't care. I just want to go on hearing the nectar of Krishna. Higher beings who frequented the earth in other ages would cease their visits. Just like you read in the Krishna book, the Rajasuya sacrifice we were discussing in class yesterday. Brahma was there, Shiva was there, representatives from so many different planets were there. That's normal. When Prithu Maharaj had his sacrifice, the four Kumaras came, Vishnu came. It's normal. But because no one's performing yajna anymore, the demigods are invisible. They don't come. And now what is everybody fascinated by? Some low-grade aliens. Ugly-looking aliens. Veda culture means become fascinated with the visits of Indra, Brahma, Shiva, the Kumaras, Narada Muni. Western culture means have your mind blown by some, you know, horrible-looking aliens. Oh, how interesting. They have all different types of aliens. Some are called the greys, very horrible gray-looking creatures. Some seem just, they seem just like the Nagas. And people are very fascinated with these reptilian-type aliens. This is how bad Kali Yuga is. They know nothing about Lord Brahma riding on his swan, Lord Shiva riding on his bull. They know nothing about this. Indra riding on Airavata. Nothing do they know about this. Everything they get is low class. Their psychic powers are low class. Their aliens are low class. Everything is low class. And they wonder why we don't care. All Vedic knowledge of subtle astral technology will almost disappear. And worst of all, the transcendental conclusions of the Vedas will become obscured. In short, both individually and collectively, constant disturbance and anxiety would be the standard of the day. The chief sage, Sutta Goswami, had become preeminently qualified by submitting to his preceptor. So the sages at Naimisaranya knew they would only benefit by submitting to him. But what does Western culture teach you? Don't submit to anyone. Everybody knows what's best. One famous Western philosopher, Albert Camus, he said, don't try to lead me and don't try to follow me. Just walk together with me through the chaos. Everyone thinks this is brilliant. Don't try to lead me. Don't try to follow me. Just walk together with me through the chaos. That's what they think is very enlightened. No one knows better. The professors at the university, they think no one is right. All points of view have value. Therefore, when people hear the Vedic conclusions, they think, oh, this is dogma. This is just some kind of fanaticism. You can present to them Vedic knowledge in the most powerful, conclusive way, and they'll just look you in the face and say, well, that's just your opinion. Everybody's got a right to find their own way. Or what else do they say? All paths lead to the same goal. Then you ask them, okay, even if that's true, what's the goal? Well, how can you say all paths lead to the same goal, and you don't even know what the goal is? So this madness is going on. No one accepts any authority. And if you try to accept authority, they criticize you. You're mindless. You can't think for yourself. Sometimes even our own devotees, when they become a little illusioned, they criticize if you accept authority. This is all part of Kali Yuga. But we are wanting to hold tight to the Vedic injunctions. The supreme authority is Krishna. As soon as you don't accept any authority, you're also not accepting Krishna. If anyone has any authority, it's only in relation to Krishna. So the sages of Naimasaranya, they knew. Just like Sutta Goswami has become qualified by surrendering to his preceptors, we will become qualified by surrendering to Sutta Goswami. And in the future, those who surrender to us, they'll become qualified. In this way, things go on and on and on. That is Vedic culture. So what did they say? Tungna sandashito dhatra justarang nistatir sitang kaling sattva harang pungsang karnadhara evarnavam. We think that we have met your goodness by the will of providence, just so we may accept you as captain of the ship. For those who desire to cross the difficult ocean of Kali, which deteriorates all the good qualities of a human being. Here is the Vedic process of acquiring knowledge through disciplined succession, a chain that traces itself beyond the cosmos to Bhagavan himself. The Vedic injunction is achincha kalute bhava. No need to waste time arguing or speculating about things beyond the range of the senses and intellect. Just find a qualified authority and through hearing, learn what is beyond the limited. Adjust your lifestyle according to what you hear and then experience what you hear. By this process, today's student becomes tomorrow's master, and in this way, Vedic knowledge perpetuates itself. So we don't have blind faith. Nowhere in Bhagavad Gita does Krishna say, just believe in me. Everywhere, Krishna is giving you the process to verify what he's saying. So what do you want out of Krishna? You want to find out if Krishna exists? Take the process Krishna gives. You'll experience Krishna. Krishna says, Rasaham apsukonteya, I am the taste of water. So when you drink water, you think Krishna is the taste. That's becoming Krishna conscious. Now, don't make the mistake of thinking, well, Krishna is just being poetic. I am the taste of water. I am the light of the sun and the moon. This is just some kind of poetic stuff. No, Krishna is personally giving you specific things to meditate on so you can become Krishna conscious. Because Krishna has picked these things out, therefore we focus on them. Krishna says, I'm the taste in water. So we don't say, well, there's so many things and this is just an example of Krishna being artistic. No. We focus on what Krishna has specifically given us. Then we can understand the whole, understand everything. If you overlook what Krishna specifically gives you, how can you make any progress? So Krishna has picked certain things out. I am the taste of water. I am the light of the sun and the moon. So we think like that. And that's remembering Krishna. He told Arjuna, Maya sakta manaparta yogam yunjan marashraya asamsayam samagram mam itagyasasitatschanu. Listen to me, Arjuna. I'm going to teach you how your mind can become attached to me. You'll know everything without a doubt, in full. I'll teach you that. That's Bhagavad Gita. Krishna does not say, just believe in me. Believe, and you'll be liberated. No. He says, always think of me. Become my devotee. So Krishna is giving the knowledge through sound vibration. If you apply it in your life, you'll experience. So who here does not want to experience Krishna? Krishna even says, Dharma Viruta Bhuteshu Kamosri Bhartashava. I am sex life in accordance with religious principles, in accordance with Dharma. I have no experience, but Prabhupada said you can experience Krishna in this way. So this is Bhagavad Gita. No belief, no dogma, experience. But experience achieved on the basis of Krishna's instructions. Any questions at this point? Yeah.
In these so-called New Age philosophers, they often put forward the idea that you're narrow-minded because you have a clearly defined path. You're not being open-minded because you're only following one thing.
They say we're narrow-minded because we have a clearly defined path. So tell them next time they're going to a city. Let's say they're going to Sydney. Tell them, don't take any map. No map. They should just stumble around the city. Don't have any clearly defined destination. Don't follow any clearly defined route. In fact, let them try to do that just to get to the airport in Perth. Have no defined way of getting there, no defined goal. They say all these things, but they don't follow. What actually are they doing? While glorifying the undefined, their whole life is very defined. Where is the sense gratification? That's very well defined. But if you try to follow Krishna, oh, that's not good. Krishna cannot be supreme. He's too well defined. When you look in their own life, you see it's very well defined. There must be sense gratification at every moment, and we will work for sense gratification. No one lives their life in an undefined way. The next time they go on a journey, let them do it in an undefined way. No, they want to know everything. They got to get a Lonely Planet's guidebook. They got to, talk to their friends. What's it like going to Bali? How's the currency there now? What's the best hotel to stay at? They want everything completely understood. They say like this because they're envious of Krishna. It's just pure envy. Tell them, ask them to see their undefined girlfriend. Any other questions? Let's see if we have it. A lot of these things you know, but this book is meant for persons who don't know so much. It's meant to introduce them to Krishna consciousness. The four seasons of the universe. Understanding the yuga cycle takes us once again to the three modes of nature. The four Vedic millenniums are manifestations of these modes. In the best period, such a yuga, also known as the age of truth, the mode of goodness predominates, vice is almost unknown. Now, this is very important because people, especially at universities, they'll always tell you that, look, you got to understand, mankind is the way it is. Humanity, it's always going to be problematic. People always have their shortcomings. That's not true. We don't accept that. In Satyuga, there practically was no vice. But what these people today are trying to tell you is that the way people are now, that's the way it's always been. You just got to learn to live with it, humans with their vices and shortcomings. In that way, everybody peacefully accepts such a hellish situation because they have no knowledge of anything better. We don't accept this. We don't accept the situation today because through Srimad Bhagavatam, we know people were much better. So we are not at all satisfied with the situation today. The worst era, Kali Yuga, is the antithesis of Satya Yuga. Virtue is almost unknown. In the age of quarrel, the mode of ignorance reigns. In the other two yugas, either passion is dominant, Treta Yuga, or a blend of passion and ignorance, Dwarpa Yuga. Vice enters in the second yuga, spreads in the third, and saturates the fourth. So once again, we have this cultural degradation. The first yuga, no vice. The second one, vice enters. The third one, vice spreads. And the fourth one, vice overruns everything. Satya Yuga. The age of truth is the crown of material existence, the best of times. Today we would think it heavenly, a paradise lost. The Vedic view, however, holds that although pristine and sublime, Satya Yuga is still within the purview of material existence. In this first age, the minds of all the people are described as self-effulgent, brilliant in clarity and spiritual perception. Humanity delights in spiritual knowledge and austerity. The Bhagavatam 12th canto says, "The people of Satya Yuga are for the most part self-satisfied, merciful, friendly to all, peaceful, sober, and tolerant. They take their pleasure from within, see all things equally, and always endeavor diligently for spiritual perfection." Generally, everyone's mind, intelligence, and senses are solidly fixed in the mode of goodness, at the very least. Most of the population, though, are paramahansas, transcendentalists beyond even the mode of goodness. The Bhagavatam says that in such yuga there wasn't even really Varnashram Dharma. There's just one class of humans, the Hamsas, swan-like persons. At that time, because of the extremely exalted intelligence of humanity, the Vedic information was said to be available compressed into one Veda, rather than a proliferation of many texts. According to Vedic tradition, as the yuga cycle progressed, the same compacted Vedic information became expanded into many explanatory branches. We should note, however, that from the Vedic viewpoint, this pragmatic expansion does not imply the assimilation or creation of new doctrines. This is a very important point, because scholars of Indology, they'll tell you that, well, okay, the Vedas, they developed over some thousands of years. Within the past 3,000 years, the Vedas originated and developed. And so many of the doctrines of the Vedas evolved over a period of time. That's the way it is, you know. These so-called religions, they start off with some original precepts, and then they add things on as they go along. So that's the Vedic history. Don't think that that is what you are reading in the Bhagavatam when it says that first there was one Veda and then Vyasadev expanded the Vedas, writing commentaries on the Vedas, entrusting different parts of the Vedas to different lines of teachers for expansion and development. Do not think that this means they're making up new truth No, they're simply elucidating, making it easier for everyone to understand. Just like Vedanta Sutra, such concise statements. Sutra means essential truth, very concisely spoken. Just like Janmadhyasutta, that's Vedanta Sutra, one shloka. The absolute truth is that from which everything emanates. But Srimad Bhagavatam takes that one shloka and spends so much time expanding it. So don't think that when you read that the Vedas were expanded and there were different divisions created, don't think that this means new knowledge was created. No. The same original knowledge is just expanded. When you're very intelligent, you don't need to have elucidations. You know it all just from a little seed. You can see everything. The original Bhagavatam is what? Four verses. So what Vyasadeva is doing is, for the sake of persons who can't see all the compressed knowledge within the seed, he's opening things up. He's not creating new knowledge. But this is what the scholars think. That by the time 500 AD came around, 500 years after Christ, this Krishna cult started getting real popular, and so the crafty brahmanas had to figure out a way how to stick Krishna into the Vedas, so they made this text up called Srimad Bhagavatam. This is what they say. Obviously we don't accept this nonsense. The waning intellectual powers of humanity required an expansive elucidation. Hence, the same concise Vedic codes were elaborated upon at length, making their comprehension easier for lesser brains. Now, think about this. Scholars today, they can't find any example of writing in India earlier than 500 BC. So they say, therefore, whatever people existed in India before 500 BC weren't that intelligent because they didn't have writing. The earliest they find is the edicts of Emperor Ashoka around 500 BC. He was the king who converted to Buddhism, and he left behind stone pillars throughout India in which he wrote his edicts or government maxims, government laws, people should practice the morality of Buddhism, be very noble and treat everyone nicely. So that's the earliest example of writing in India. So people naturally think, well, they just didn't have it that much together before then. Only in 500 BC did they figure out how to get some writing together. The Vedic conclusion is completely the opposite. Writing means people are declining in intelligence. They actually didn't need to write things down before because their brains were sharper. This is completely the opposite of what Westerners think. Oh, if you write things down, when people get writing, they're more civilized and more advanced. No, the Vedic view is, when you have to write things down, it means your brain is dull. So everything is opposite. Any questions? So this is just a sample of what we're trying to do here. I don't want to impose upon you too much. Any of our guests have any questions? So, is it easy to understand? Yes?
Where are we moving now?
Where are we moving? Where is who moving?
Oh, here.
Huh?
Where
are you moving?
Yes.
Well, you have to tell us about your lifestyle, then we can say where you are moving. What is your lifestyle like? Oh, that's very bad then. Very bad. Normal human beings today, very bad. We were discussing this in the beginning. If you want to be doing things properly, you have to be abnormal. What is abnormal? That means you have knowledge of who you are. That you're not the body, you are spirit, soul, part of Krishna, and you're meant to render service to Krishna. That is abnormal. In previous yugas or millenniums, that was the normal thing. Now it is abnormal. So it's not good to be a normal human being. Let me ask you, can you give me one good reason why it's good to be a normal human being? Name one good thing about society today.
We're playing here in society, playing with Krishna.
Hmm?
Yes, here we are playing. We are society. We are playing with Krishna.
This is not wider society. This is a small gathering of devotees of Krishna. There are 1 million people in Perth. They're not here. So, about the wider society, you name one good thing.
A lot of people are becoming vegetarian nowadays.
Do they offer their food to Krishna? So now they're vegetarian thieves instead of meat-eating thieves, huh? Srila Prabhupada explained, vegetarian is not so much big credit. So many animals are vegetarians. It's something, but not such a big credit. Actually, Prabhupada said that if Krishna told us to eat meat, we would eat meat. But he says, you can only offer me certain things. So the real reason why we do not eat meat is because we can't offer it to Krishna. And a Vaishnav, whatever he eats, he offers to Krishna. So Krishna doesn't accept meat. That's the real reason. It just so happens that meat is very bad for your health, and to eat meat you cause so much pain and suffering to other creatures. But the real reason is Krishna doesn't want it offered to him. Krishna can eat whole universes, but still he says, you offer me leaf, fruit, flower, water, I'll accept, if it's with devotion. But you cannot restrict Krishna. He can eat unlimited universes. So, people may be becoming vegetarians, but they're still stealing. They don't recognize the supreme proprietor. They don't perform any yajna, any sacrifice. They don't acknowledge the maintainer, the supreme maintainer. They give no acknowledgement of that. And even if you say there's some little credit for being vegetarian, look at what else they're doing. All the things, the other things. So their little rise in vegetarianism will not save them. You know about the habits of people today? Very abominable. Can you name one good thing? That makes you feel proud to be a human being. It's difficult. Can someone else do this? Name one good thing about human society today. Vegetarianism without offering the food to Krishna means they're eating sin. That is stated in Bhagavad Gita. Those who don't offer their food in yajna, in sacrifice, are eating only sin. So we are not vegetarians, we are Krishnatarians. We only eat Krishna prasad. Otherwise, you know, Hitler was interested in vegetarianism. I've even heard Hitler was a vegetarian. Yes, so? So please, normal human being, you tell me what is good about, why should we be a normal human being? What does a normal human being do? Work hard and make money, and what's the money for? What is the purpose of money?
To spend the right way.
And what is the right way? What's the right way? No, let him speak. He's the normal human being. What is the right way? No. Maybe you give your example. How do you spend? You're working? Okay, how do you spend? Yes. Oh, that's different. You give to the Krishna temple? You give to Krishna? That is something different. Krishna in Bhagavad Gita says, don't even give to the demigods, you give to him. Kamais tais tai hitagana prapadjante nidevata. Those who are influenced by lusty intelligence, they want to worship the demigods. Krishna says that in the Gita. It's considered illegal. Bribing the government officers instead of going right to the topmost and giving your tax money there. All right, so you're spending on mortgage, clothes, food. That means you're spending on family life. Okay, what is the purpose of the family life, though? Huh? Otherwise, families are going on in every species of life. Ants, horses, rabbits, they all have families. So if we're going to spend on family life, it must be a real...